Welcome to The Bridge, the radio ministry of The Bridge Bible Fellowship in Reseda, California, featuring the Bible teaching of Pastor Paul Brown. Today, Pastor Paul will be continuing a verse-by-verse study of the book of Ecclesiastes in chapters 3 and 4.
Jesus is the bridge, the way to life eternal. Come and see, come and live, come and grow. Come and see, come and live, come and grow.
Good morning. This is an exciting weekend for us at the Bridge Bible Fellowship as we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of Reseda First Baptist Church. That is the church that we merged together with about 10 years ago, and this weekend we're having a huge celebration. So if you would like to join us, please do come tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and join us in Reseda at the Bridge Bible Fellowship as we celebrate 75 years of God's faithfulness through the church there in Reseda. Well, as we come back to Ecclesiastes today, I was reflecting on all of the terrorist activity that's been happening recently around the world. So many evil things have been done, and so often in the name of religion. When these things happen, a common question occurs. People will say this: is there an all-powerful good God? And is he actually controlling the affairs of the world? Because if there is a God like that, why do so many horrible things happen? Is suffering and evil a paradox that causes us to deny God? Or is it a pointer that directs us to trust him even more? Last week, we started looking at Solomon's perspective in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. After doing a calculation that life adds up to zero and identifying the curiosity that God has placed in our hearts for things that really matter, that are eternal, he came to three conclusions. Enjoy life, perspective is a gift, and God controls life, I don't. He graciously repeats history so we can see his control. And he graciously repeats it in our personal lives so that we can learn valuable lessons. The greatest lesson is to fear him. But here's the big question. If God's plan is so beautiful, then why are there paradoxes in life like this? Things that don't seem to be beautiful. In fact, things that seem to be horrid. Are these things paradoxes, or do they point to a God who providentially rules the world? Let's reason with Solomon and work through the perspective to the paradoxes, starting in chapter 3, verse 16. Solomon is going to highlight six paradoxes. These are anomalies, apparent contradictions. Each is introduced by a similar phrase. In chapter 3, verse 16, he says, "Furthermore, I have seen." In verse 18, "I said to myself." In chapter 4, verse 4, "I have seen." In chapter 4, verse 1 and 7, "I looked again." Each of these is lead-in to another paradox. The only one that isn't that way is in chapter 4, verse 13. And all of these are focusing on the human perspective. What is life like under the sun? Here's the question. If God is really good and he's really in control, then why is there, and here's the first paradox, injustice? Verse 16 and 17. "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness." Tell me, have you ever heard of a corrupt lawyer or judge or politician? That's what he's referring to. Wickedness in the place where justice is supposed to take place. But here's what's even worse. Have you ever heard of a corrupt religious leader? You go expecting righteousness, and what you get is wickedness. You find people that are greedy, perverted, self-absorbed, all in the name of religion. And they use their religion to manipulate people to fulfill their own selfish desires. These folks are harming the innocent and helping the guilty. This evil is obviously wrong, and it cries out to us for judgment. I believe most of us can handle sad endings, but we don't like unjust endings. Solomon says in verse 17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every matter and for every deed is there. When he says, I said to myself, he's drawing his own conclusions. This is the natural realm. Even a natural man, apart from divine revelation, believes at times there is a supreme being. Even the natural man, apart from divine revelation, believes that a supreme being must do something about this injustice. God will judge the legal, political, and religious hypocrite. Now, here's a problem, though. People tell me all the time they want God to stop evil, but they don't want God to stop their personal sin. What would happen if God killed everybody that sinned? There would be nobody left. So where does God stop? God chooses to be patient. He brings judgment at the appropriate time. There's a coming day when all injustices will be judged. So for now, he allows sinful men to do unjust things, and this is a reminder. We're not in control, and we need God. So injustice is not a paradox that denies God. It's a pointer that tells us there is a God, and we're looking to him to bring justice that no one else will. The second paradox he brings up is death. In verses 18 through 22, he talks about the sons of men and says, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Now, unfortunately, this passage is often used by cults to teach things that are not biblical, like soul sleep or annihilation of the wicked dead. That is not Solomon's point. This is not doctrinal revelation. This is human observation. He's still talking under the sun. Death brings everybody to a level playing field. That's his point. We have eternity in our hearts, and we have death in our bodies. This shows how frail we are because we are sons of men, or literally, sons of Adam. And when Adam sinned, he began dying, and we are all dying as well. And God has tested us, verse 18 said. He's winnowing or sifting us to reveal what we really are like on our own. We're dying. We are weak. And just like the animals, we're heading to the same place, our grave. He's not talking about the animals are going to heaven. That's another theological discussion for another time. Now, people are confused by verse 21 because it's written in many translations as a question. But the Hebrew construction does not demand that. I believe it's a statement. I think he's saying that men and beasts actually differ. They both die and their bodies return to the dust, but man's spirit goes upward to God either for judgment or blessing, and the animal spirit doesn't. We cannot come back from death for a second chance at this life either, Hebrews 9:27 tells us. It's appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. So verse 22, he says, I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Here's his conclusion. Line up with God's plan, and you can enjoy every moment. You may not know what the future holds, although you do know you're going to die. But you can live each moment to please God and enjoy whatever he may bring. Now, he does ask a question at the end. What will, man doesn't know what will bring him to see what will occur after him. But guess what? We know somebody who died and rose again. And he told us what's after the grave. His name is Jesus. And he told us that we could be with him in his eternal kingdom by faith and trust in him and what he did for us on the cross. So death is a pointer, once again, to God's providence. It reminds us of our dependence upon him, and it causes us to enjoy life while we have it. Well, there's a third paradox he brings up. It's oppression, chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. Oppression is a horrible thing. And the oppressed cry out, and it appears no one is listening and no one is comforting them. But Solomon says the oppressor is the same way. Eventually, in his future, he'll be even worse off. Jesus said about Judas, it would have been better for him if he had never been born. If you're looking for happiness in this world horizontally, you're not going to find it. What you're going to find is misery, injustice, pain, and oppression. And he even concludes that non-existence is preferred over existence. So many people have felt that way. Job felt that way in chapter 3 of his book. His life was so horrific, he wished he'd never been born. Perhaps you're feeling that way right now. But there is a solution. The solution that you'd be better if you'd never been born is what you think when you're under the sun. And so many people feel that way. Have you ever heard anybody say, I don't want to bring any children into this sick world? Why not? Why wouldn't you? Because you believe that something is wrong. But here's a tough question. Here's a philosophical question. How can there be wrong if there's no God? Even oppression that screams out to every one of us because we have eternity in our hearts, every one of us sees oppression and go, it is wrong. Why is it wrong? Because God says it's wrong. So even oppression points us to a God who allows these things to happen so we'll draw closer to him. This leads to another paradox, rivalry, in verses 4 through 6. I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. Have you noticed this in the business world? Success is greeted with envy instead of praise. This goes all the way back to the garden. Cain treated Abel horribly and killed him. Saul was envious of the praise going to David and tried to kill him. Healthy competition can move us to do our best, but can also turn us to bitter envy. I see this so often in business. People trying to outshine the other guy who works alongside of them, or they try to make sure the other guy doesn't outshine them. Life is driven by a competitive spirit. You've heard the phrase, it's a dog-eat-dog world. We are envious of our neighbors, we nurse our resentments, and we enjoy our grievances. This kind of person is even acceptable in our society. People who are envious and have rivalries with their coworkers. If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Bridge, the radio ministry of the Bridge Bible Fellowship in Reseda, California. I'm Pastor Paul Brown, and we're studying in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, now in verse 4. Solomon makes the observation that men can become workaholics, driven to be the best, to outshine their neighbor. And when that doesn't work, when they realize it's not working and it's a vain thing, verse 5 says that they can fold their hands into retreat, become lazy and do nothing. This is a foolish choice because it leads to poverty, and poverty is not a good thing. So verse 6, he says, some people won't go that way. They won't be a workaholic. They won't be lazy. They'll just go for moderation, one hand full of rest. In other words, one hand is relaxing, the other hand's working hard. Proverbs 16:8 says, better is a little with righteousness than great income with injustice. Better than a workaholic trying to find satisfaction but chasing the wind. So rivalry, once again, is a pointer to God's providence. It shows us what is really inside of us and makes us aware that only God can give ultimate satisfaction. Solomon moves on to another paradox, the fifth one, which is loneliness in verses 7 through 12. Then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, "And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart." Here's what Solomon is trying to say. If you realize that our world is full of oppression and rivalry and intense hatred between people, one of the solutions may be isolationism. I'll just go avoid people altogether, and I'll just not be hurt by them. So in verse 8, you have Mr. Isolation, who retreats so he'll never be hurt again. Later in verse 8, you have Mr. No Vacation. He works and works and works, and he brags about the fact that he never takes time off. But ultimately, he's Mr. Deprivation. He deprives himself even of pleasure. His eyes were not satisfied with riches. He's worked so hard to accumulate, but he doesn't enjoy it. He's not content, he's not happy, and he's not asking the right questions. He finally asks the question, "And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? What's the point? Why do I live? Why do I work? Why am I here?" And what's the conclusion? "Even though I live in a world of injustice and oppression where people hurt one another, I know I was created for fellowship." That's what he talks about in verses 9 through 12. There's a better return on investment this way. There's an advantage. There is a profit. When you are joining with other people, in verse 10, there's assistance. In verse 11, there's comfort. In verse 12, there's mutual defense. You are so much better off in relationships, even though you live in a world where relationships are broken and they're not always positive. The loneliness you feel deep inside is a pointer, once again, that God is there, and he wants to meet that need. He wants you to have fellowship with him, a restored relationship with him that will then change every other relationship you have. That leads to the sixth paradox, verses 13 through 16, fleeting popularity and political power. He says, "A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity and striving after wind." This time Solomon reverses the order of the previous five. Now he gives the answer first and the obstacles last. Have you ever heard someone say something like this? "I gave my whole life to serving the Lord, and now I am old and have nothing, and nobody appreciates what I've done. God must not be there, or if he is, he must not care. My whole life was wasted." Is that true? No. That's just the world in which we live. This is not our final resting place. In verse 13, he talks about an old, foolish king who forgets where he came from and he's no longer teachable. And then a king in verse 14 who believes he actually deserves the throne. In verse 15, people clamor for the one they think will bring all the answers, but he doesn't deserve the throne either. I find that quite fascinating, don't you? People clamor and clamor for a certain person to be president of the U.S., and then when he comes, they're still not happy. Verse 16, why? Because people are fickle. Hero today, bum tomorrow. People are clamoring for a king who will do away with oppression, injustice, and rivalry. They have eternity in their hearts. They long for a place where things are right. They long for a place where everything is beautiful in its time. What are they really longing for? They're longing for the day when God will rule righteously on the earth. Until then, those in politics will have fleeting popularity and fleeting political power. And this once again points us to a coming king, God himself, who will rule and reign forever. Nietzsche said once, quote, "I wish I had the comfort that some of my intellectual colleagues who believe in God, but I don't have it," unquote. He knew people that knew God. He saw the comfort it brought them in their lives, and he wished he had it, but he didn't. Life under the sun is hard. We live in a sinful, fallen world. In this present world, there's injustice, there's death, there's oppression, there's rivalry, there's loneliness, there's fleeting popularity and political power. How can God's beautiful plan fit in with all these paradoxes? Well, the answer is they're not paradoxes. They're pointers. God left them here to show us we've got a problem. We need a right relationship with him. We need to be restored to him. And if we didn't have these problems, we would never admit that we're sinful. We would never admit we have a need for salvation. Without these problems, we wouldn't know that there are consequences to our actions. What is the key? Solomon's conclusion? God wants us to fear him. He is patiently allowing us to roam around and do our thing and make mistakes and realize how desperately we need him. People propose this problem of suffering and evil. They say if God is all good, he'll do it. If God is all powerful, he can do it. But evil is not yet defeated, so therefore there is no God. Solomon's answer is quite different. God is good. He will do it. God is all powerful. He can do it. Evil is not yet defeated, but someday it will be. The fact that there is injustice in the world today proves there must be a day of justice coming. There is a time for everything, and there is a day coming when evil will be defeated. God is in control, my dear friends. In the past, Jesus went to the cross. Evil was defeated. In the future, he will have a crown. Evil will be done away with completely. In the present time, there's compassion. God is patiently calling people to be dissatisfied with this world so that they will find eternal satisfaction in him. How about you? Have you found peace in your relationship with God? Have you understood what Jesus has done for you? He came, lived a sinless life, suffered and died on the cross, paid the penalty for your sins, rose from the dead, conquered sin and death, ascended to heaven, and he's coming back soon. He wants to be the answer to your problems. Give your life to him today.
You have been listening to The Bridge with Pastor Paul Brown of the Bridge Bible Fellowship in Reseda, California. We would love to have you join us for a worship service at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning. Pastor Paul is currently teaching through the book of Ephesians. We are located at 18644 Sherman Way in Reseda, California. That is 3 blocks west of Reseda Boulevard on Sherman Way. If you want more information about our church, want to listen to previous sermons and radio broadcasts, and or desire to financially support this radio ministry, please go to our website at www.thebridgebiblefellowship.com. And please, join us again next Saturday at 7:30 a.m. here on 99.5 KKLA, when Pastor Paul will continue his verse-by-verse study of the book of Ecclesiastes.